The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, good afternoon, good day. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. It's time for News Dissector Radio, which is an extension and a support for the blog I write every morning, Dissecting the News, News Dissector, which is at newsdissector.com. So welcome to News Dissector Radio. We tend to talk with some of the people whose work we cite or discuss in the blog and try to have a show that's relevant, timely, and interesting to listen to with guests that you may not have heard before. And that's what I'm here trying to do. The number here, the call-in line, is 888-874-4888. That number again, toll-free, 888-874-4888, if you want to join us. Those people who have been with me on this program or have seen my film Plunder or read my book The Crime of Our Time know that I am extremely focused on the economic crisis in our country, trying to understand it, trying to explain it, trying to analyze it. I'm proud to say that I have a new contribution to this debate out now from Cosimo Books. They have reprinted the Financial Crisis Inquiry Report, complete with dissenting views, including mine. I've written the foreword to this edition of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report, a Cosimo report, and it's out now. It's on Amazon and elsewhere, wherever you can find books. So I've taken a critical view of all of this, and one of the people whose work I relied on in developing that critique is going to be on with me in a minute. Her name, Eve Smith. She's the editor of the amazing NakedCapitalism.com blog. And, you know, I think it's a must read every day. It's out by 7:03 every morning like clockwork. And she looks at and analyzes the main news stories, carries links from all the economic news and all the most interesting people writing about these issues. So Naked Capitalism coming up. And then in the second half hour, we're going to meet the great veteran of civil rights reporting, John Siegenthaler, was the editor of the Nashville Tennessean for many years. Now has been involved with the Freedom Center in Nashville, promoting freedom of speech and the First Amendment, freedom of the press. John will be talking with us. He's been back in the news to some small degree because of recent films about the Freedom Rides, Stanley Nelson's great documentary. And John was a journalist who was actually beaten up while covering the Freedom Rides. And so John will be joining us. We'll be sort of taking a look at what's happening in the South all these years later and talking about that. So that's what I have in store for you today. Bear in mind that this morning the unemployment figures came out again. A pathetic number of jobs were created. Unemployment has now gone up again to 9.1. So this is not a good sign, certainly for the Obama administration and its efforts to do something about the jobs and economic crisis. It's not a good thing for those people out there looking for work and not finding it or looking to upgrade the work that they have. So we're in an economic crisis, and in fact, just yesterday on NakedCapitalism.com, there was an article that I want to discuss, which suggests that we are on the verge of a great, great depression. Yastrow, a frequent guest on CNBC, Peter Yastrow, has that article on Naked Capitalism on the Washington's blog, which also appears, some of it appears on Naked Capitalism. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. Stay with me. News Dissector Radio. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, right here, right now.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off, workers paid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking in AAA. Grandpa loses 401k. Plunder.
Plunder, plunder, plunder. Eve Smith, are you with me this morning?
Yes, I am.
Hey, this afternoon. I wanted you to hear some of the music, the song that was done for my film Plunder, which actually has the actual voice of Bernard Madoff, you know, admitting to his crime. And I integrated that into the song that was written and performed on the soundtrack of Plunder to remind us that these issues are not over yet and are very much with us. And I'm really delighted to have you on because I'm a great admirer of what you do and a follower of your blog, a religious follower, I might add. And I have a funny story to tell you to get things going here. I was in Tehran, Iran, not that long ago, in November, as a judge in a film festival. We met with the culture minister of Iran. And he was basically talking about how modern everything is there and how the Internet is this sophisticated tool that millions of people use. You know, Iran is known by a code name by a lot of people as Blogostan because there are so many bloggers in Iran. So I, you know, raised my hand. I said, excuse me, Mr. Minister, I just have a concern here. Your filtering software is not letting me gain access to some of the blogs that I rely on to understand what's happening to the world economy, including the Iranian economy. He says, oh, really? What can't you see? I said, well, I am an adherent of a blog, which you should check out, too, called Naked Capitalism. And he said, what? Naked? He says, that's probably why it's being filtered, because of the name. And then he went on to tell me, Eve, essentially, you know, talk to any young person here and they'll tell you how to get around the filters, okay? So he was aware that despite their best efforts to censor things that, you know, words that they don't like and the like, the people of Iran are able to get around it and access what's happening. So let's start with today. The latest unemployment numbers are out. You know, the number of jobs created, I think, what, 54,000, when they think you need 200,000 each month to keep the economy or in some kind of recovery mode. The unemployment figures are now 9.1, which I'm sure if adjusted and captured the reality of it would be a lot higher. What's your take on this?
No, it's definitely the numbers. The whole series of data releases recently have been very disappointing. I mean, the unemployment numbers are every bit as bad as you suggest. You know, people were expecting some softening this month. You're right, the number was 54,000. They were expecting the consensus was more like 150, 165,000. And you're correct, you need over 200,000 just to absorb the increase in workers coming into the economy. So if you're going to make any headway on unemployment, you actually need more jobs than that being created. On top of that, a lot of people have discussed the fact that this now roughly 9.9% unemployment number, headline unemployment number, it's, you know, today it nicked up to 9.1%, really does understate how bad things are, because over the years there have been tweaks to the unemployment number so that they count fewer and fewer discouraged workers. You know, one of the better measures of unemployment, which is the broader one that does include some but not all discouraged workers, comes up with a number that's more like 16%, which I think is the way most people feel about the economy right now. That, I mean, the numbers around unemployment are pretty desperate. There are, the last figures I saw was there are for every one job opening, there are six people looking for a job. So there's just this big mismatch.
It's a calamity. And, you know, here in New York, for example, I was told that 50% of all black men are out of work.
Right.
50%. I mean, if you go into the unemployment figures for minorities or for young people, it's disastrous. And here we are, the beginning of a summer where kids are hoping to get summer jobs. And, you know, there are none, or there are very few, and it's very discouraging. And I think the long-term consequences of this can be extremely serious, because why stay in school and all of that if you can't find work when you get out of school? So this is and it's part of the larger problem of our economy. And yesterday, in your blog, you carry this article, which was just kind of a mind-blower, in which basically it was projected that we are on the verge of a great, great depression. And this is the views of Peter Yastrow, of Yastrow Origer, a trader. We're on the verge of a great, great depression. The Federal Reserve knows it, he told CNBC. And then this Washington's blog, I don't know who Washington is here. I don't think it's George the original. It's just so brilliant at synthesizing this information. And I just want to read this because I want to get your take on it, okay? He says, the following experts have at some point during the last 2 years said that the economic crisis could be worse than the Great Depression. Who are these experts? Listen to this. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, economic scholar and former Federal Reserve Governor Frederick Mishkin, the head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman, former Goldman Sachs chairman John Whitehead, economic professors Barry Eigengreen and Kevin O'Rourke, investment advisor, risk expert, and black swan author Nassim Nicholas Taleb, well-known PhD economist Mark Faber, Morgan Stanley's UK equity strategist Graham Seeker, former chief credit officer at Fannie Mae Edward J. Pinto, billionaire investor George Soros, senior Bush minister, British minister, excuse me, Ed Balls. All of them saying at some point in the last 2 years that the economic crisis could be worse than the Great Depression. What say you, Eve?
Well, right now we're pursuing very bad policies. You know, we had, as everyone knows, the situation in 2008 and 2009, or 2007, 2008 was very dire. And what the officialdom did all around the world was try to patch up the old system with duct tape and baling wire. The problem with that is that we were at the end of an economic paradigm that could not continue. What's happened in the U.S. and, you know, advanced economies generally is that they've adopted this neoliberal, you know, what they call neoclassical economic paradigm where everything that's done by markets is considered to be virtuous and, God forfend, you interfere with them. Well, the problem with that view is that it's based on economic theories that assume that the economy goes to equilibrium. And therefore, you don't have to worry about stability. You can just let people do, you know, making things more efficient is always better. Well, the problem with that view is that it totally ignores how financial markets affect the economy. And financial markets don't have any propensity to equilibrium. Look at how often we have financial crashes. So the result has been we've had stagnant worker wages, and we've had increasing consumer debt levels to try to make up for the fact that workers just aren't making any headway. Now, if we'd had more sensible economic policies when in the early 80s when the U.S. started getting big trade deficits, people would have worried. In the old days, that would have been seen as a very bad sign. There would have been a lot of concern about what we should do about this problem. Instead, there was this complacent reaction to it. And consumers can only take so much debt. I mean, we saw what happened on the eve of the crisis. You know, people were extracting, the savings rate was close to zero, and people were extracting equity from their homes. And, you know, now we're living with the aftermath of that. And the problem is that we now have these austerian policies, which are the wrong thing to do when you've got an economic downturn. When you've got a downturn, it's like, you know, governments are not in the same situation as households. And the backers of finance are sort of pushing the idea that they're the same and we should be concerned about government debt levels when that's just not the big issue. When things turn down, you really have to, it's like steering the car into the skid. You have to keep steering into the car until you've really got a solid recovery. And instead we've had government cheerleading instead, bank-friendly policies, and very little to help the average person who's hurting.
So basically, we're doing everything we can to make it worse, it seems like. I mean, some of the assertions in this article, states and cities in worse shape since the Great Depression. States and cities are in dire financial straits, and many may default in 2011. California is issuing IOUs for only the second time since the Great Depression. So, you know, we're in a situation where almost every indicator is worrying and disturbing, and yet what we have, it seems like, is this great push by the Tea Party-driven Republicans to basically cut back everything, cut it more, you know. And what's the consequence of that likely to be?
Well, we see what's happening in Europe. I mean, the poster children for what happened is Latvia and Ireland. Both of them were forced to adopt austerity programs when their governments had got very big debt levels. And in the Irish case, it wasn't even government overspending. It was that they had a banking system that went bust like ours, and it was so large compared to the economy that it blew out their debt levels, you know, just by that fact alone. And you you can't starve your way back to health is the bottom line. That what happens is, you know, sort of intuitively, it's, again, it goes back to that government spending is not the same as household spending. When you cut back on government spending, you shrink the economy. You know, somebody's income is somebody else's spending.
Right.
So you shrink the economy, and instead of debt levels getting better, because what everybody worries about is the ratio of debt to GDP, the debt levels get worse because the economy shrinks even faster than the spending cuts reduce the size of the deficit.
There was an article the other day that suggested that the floods in the Mississippi and the effort to basically put money into the area for recovery after tornadoes and all the rest of it are having a positive economic stimulative effect because all this government money is going in there. So in a sense, the only places that see a turnaround in the economy are places experiencing a disaster. And the fact that the government has to respond to the disaster. It seems like we're crazy. Now, one of the things you've been writing about, and there's a relationship here that I wanted to explore with you. While all this is going on, the economy is sinking and all the rest of it, Wall Street seems to be booming. And the people on Wall Street who have been accused, certainly in so many reports and articles and all the rest of this, of massive irresponsibility, if not criminality, in connection with the financial crisis, are sort of getting away with it. There's no great hunger here to prosecute them. The state attorney general here in New York is on the verge of issuing subpoenas. The Manhattan DA today issued a subpoena for Goldman Sachs. But it doesn't seem like the response to what happened is commensurate with what happened.
No, that's correct. I mean, and unfortunately, part of it is the fact that the financial services industry succeeded in getting the rule book rewritten over the last 15 to 20 years, so that a lot of things in the old days that would have been crimes are now no longer crimes. A second thing that's helped this bad situation is that there were a couple of Supreme Court decisions that basically took, it's a little complicated technically, but there's something called secondary liability. If you're an accountant or a lawyer and you help a company, let's say cook its books, the only person who can sue you is the company. So if you're an investor who lost money, you can't go sue an accountant who was a crooked accountant. This gives management a get-out-of-jail-free card because then they can say, well, I didn't do anything. I don't know anything about that. I just relied on what my accountant said. I mean, if my accountant said it's okay, you know, how can you say I did anything bad? I'm just the idiot here running the company.
You're right about the laws. You know, they tend to protect investors before they protect consumers, certainly, and ordinary people. You're quite right about that. But there is a feeling, and, you know, it's growing and it's echoing across the whole blogosphere, across in some ways in the media whenever free discussion is permitted, which isn't that often, a tremendous amount of anger and anguish at this. The feeling that after the SNL crisis, 1,500 bankers went to jail, and today, in a much worse crisis, almost nobody is going to jail. And that's about economic justice, people's perception of fairness. You know, if you get arrested for, you know, stealing an ice cream cone and you're potentially tried and convicted of it, people who have stolen trillions of dollars seem to be getting away with it.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that's the horrible part. I mean, it's pretty well known that the U.S. has one of the highest imprisoned populations in the entire world. And this is just another illustration of this crazy two-tier system of justice that we had. You know, it's one thing to have that, you hate to say it, in the background, and now it's in everyone's face. You know, the fact that is, you know, if you work for a big bank and you engage in egregious destructive conduct, which by any common sense standard is criminal, guess what? you're going to get away with it.
And you're they're getting away with it partially because economists and writers about financial issues, you know, looking the other way. They're not really. There's a handful of people who've been writing about this with any intense understanding. And so many others are just either ignoring it or rationalizing it.
I would say even worse. There was an article, for example. There's been a new meme in a lot of articles. For example, there was one on by Roger Lowenstein, who's a very famous writer,
who went and said
nothing that happened was criminal. I mean, you've now got journalists starting to talk the Wall Street's book, as they say. It's as if they're running Wall Street's PR. And you've had other people say, well, even if it was criminal, you know, what's the point? You know, it's that old Obama line, look forward, not back. Well, you know, I'm sorry. You know, even if people really want, as you said, people want some justice here. And, you know, the short-sightedness of it is that it's, you know, tearing down the faith in our country. And it's not even going to work in terms of trying to protect the banks and the markets in the long term, because no one's going to want to be in a market that they think is crooked, where they think they're going to be treated unfairly. So this is all extremely short-sighted.
Yeah, and also, I mean, even, you know, Gretchen Morgenson, you know, at the New York Times, who I think has done a good job of exposing some real estate scams and the like. When it comes down to it, in her book, Reckless Endangerment, she doesn't really pursue the criminality of it. She was on the Channel 1, on the New York Times promotional program for the Sunday Times the other day. She said, well, look, I'm not a lawyer. I can't say if this is criminal or not. I mean, it just seems like people don't want to deal with this somehow. And, you know, the argument basically is, well, what are we going to accomplish by throwing these people in jail? We need them to create more jobs, which, by the way, not creating, right?
Well, no, it's such a backwards. I mean, the funny and sad thing is that in the UK, the people who, you know, the Bank of England gets it. They're sort of like one, and the Financial Services Authority. They're sort of two regulators in the world who understand what's going on, and they've been doing some really excellent analytical work. And there's one guy, their director, the Bank of England director for financial stability, has done some very impressive work. And one of the things he did was look at the cost of financial crises, not just the things like the TARP and the Fed's super cheap interest rates, but the real cost, which is the cost of what we're talking about at the top of the hour. You know, how many people aren't working, the fact that and it has a very long-term impact. That if you're a student and you get out of school and you don't get a job for the first couple of years, it affects your lifetime income. You're on a completely different track than you would have been otherwise. So
I just wanted to share a comment with you. You know, I just have a friend in the studio who's somebody who's been involved in media and journalism for a long time, John Ann Winchester, who has, you know, sort of, in a sense, you know, become very aroused by this whole economic inequality, economic justice issue. Do you have any comment for Eve here about this whole issue, about these guys getting away with it, so to speak?
Well, Eve, I thought what you said about synthesizing information was really important. So two things. One is not just about they're going to jail. It's about world citizens and American citizens understanding that if we don't create a whole new economy out of this, if we don't learn the lessons of the financializations of global markets, if we don't get back down to good housekeeping, what is economy? You know, it's clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean food. It's hope for future generations. So, you know, dealing with what happens with the implications of robotization, that we now have robot checkouts at the drugstores and so on. So there has to be a new global conversation about what the true new economy would be.
Comment, Eve?
Well, I don't disagree, but the problem is you're first going to have to get the financial services industry out of the position of exerting so much control. unfortunately, that's a necessary condition for the kind of conversation you'd like to see to take place. I mean, for instance, right now, we were discussing a little bit some of the austerity measures that they have in Europe. The proposal, there's now a proposal by the European Central Bank, which basically amounts to they're going to take national important elements of national sovereignty away from countries like Greece.
Yeah, I mean, this reminded me of what's happening in Michigan in Benton Harbor, an African-American city where the Republican governor has basically preempted and taken over authority there, from the voters of Benton Harbor, and is imposing, restrictions and in the name of financial responsibility that, in a sense, is disposing of democracy. So the issue of economy and democracy is very linked and is very connected, and that's why all of us need to pay more attention to all this, need to get more involved in this economic crisis. That's why I made my film Plunder, Eve, and In Debt We Trust, and I'm trying as best I can to get the word out. But what gets on the air? Too Big to Fail, which is about the anguish of Henry Paulson during the TARP days, or other films that are sort of explainers, but there's no expose, there's no real investigation, there's no real anger, there's no real sense of how people are being displaced, dispossessed from their homes, and destroyed, families being destroyed by this whole thing. It seems like very, almost like, it's a bunch of statistics and figures and, great men in suits with bow ties talking about this while people are in terrible pain.
The funny thing is the only person who's getting any press in the mainstream media telling anything vaguely like that story is Elizabeth Warren, and you can see how they're trying to shut her down. I mean, the Obama administration, basically tried getting her in the tent by having her start up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to keep her out of the limelight. And ironically, the banks are so afraid of her that their minions in Congress have been dragging them before them to try to beat up on her and intimidate her into leaving.
Yeah, she's not one to be intimidated.
And the fact that she's getting in front of cameras and saying something within the neighborhood of truth that is hardly controversial makes them foam at the mouth. I mean, it's astonishing.
And she is a Republican, I'm told, in Massachusetts, a professor at Harvard, hardly, a radical flamethrower like some people, including maybe the host of this program at times. But, we're in a situation now where people are rallying to insist that she be appointed to head this new bureau, which has been pushed into the Fed, the Consumer Protection Bureau, no longer an independent agency, and even that there's resistance to, basically a resistance to all financial reforms, all being done in the name of supposedly fighting the deficit, when in fact it's totally political at its core. And, I just want to thank you again just for coming on today. I know we didn't have enough time to get into everything, but your work is very, very important. I find it very inspiring, and I always learn something from nakedcapitalism.com, and I hope that you'll continue. Your book is Econed, which I think you people should pick up also for a real critique of the economics industry. Thank you again, Eve, for being with us. We're going out with a little song I'd like you to hear, okay?
Thank you.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo,
Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
This is Sandra B. Tate from Success Power Talk. You can listen live to me every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the very best success strategies for your life, bringing you sumptuous, exciting topics, expert guests, and panelists from all over. You will not want to miss. Email me at coach@tateworks.com if you have questions you want read on the air. If you missed any past shows, go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives to find them. Always take the best and leave the rest. Success Power Talks every Saturday, 4 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Ain't gonna let nobody do it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody do it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, do it. Keep on a talking, do it. Marching up the freedom lane. Segregation, Lord, turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. I'm gonna let segregation, Lord, turn me round. Keep on walking, yeah, keep on talking, yeah, marching up to freedom.
I'll bet our next guest has heard that song before. It's by the Freedom Singers. It's one of the great anthems of the civil rights movement. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me round. It was also very much part of the era of the freedom rides in the Deep South. And in that era and in that period, there was a journalist among many others, but certainly one journalist who stood up to report on the civil rights movement, who took a personal interest in it, who himself was actually attacked in the course of covering the civil rights movement. He's a sort of veteran. He's a legend. He's somebody I've come to at least admire and I've met, who probably doesn't remember me, but doesn't matter. John Siegenthaler is with us from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, John.
How are you? It's great to be with you. And of course, I remember you.
And that song, you know, because when I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard, I met you then, and one of my fellows, Frank Sutherland, went on to edit the great newspaper that you were associated with for all those years in Nashville.
And that's right. Frank was my successor, and I see him frequently, and I know when I talk to him, he and Natalie will both extend their best to you.
Good. Please give them my regards. Danny Schechter, the news dissector. That's what I'm known as.
Right.
John. Anyway, you know, here we are all these years later, and, you know, the various documentaries are coming out about the civil rights movement. There have been some wonderful ones, and most recently one on the Freedom Rides. I'm sure you saw it. How do you feel this history kind of resonates today with younger people, with people who didn't know about those times?
Well, you know, it's 50 years later, 50 years in May and June when the Freedom Rides really pick up the momentum that I think changed the South and changed the country. And looking back on it, again, I'm reminded how ill-informed and how the education system is failing in keeping children today abreast of what went on a half century ago that dramatically changed the life of the country. And it's we have Martin King's birthday once a year, and that gives us a chance to reminisce. But This was a powerful documentary on the Freedom Rides, and I think it brought home in ways that nothing else has. One, the level of violence, the brutality and hostility that existed for African Americans all across the South. Young people have no sense of that, and you know, you can make a case that we should forget it, but you know, we forget it. We forget it at the risk of having it happen again. So I'm very excited about this anniversary and the celebration that's going on to take us back and help us remember the past.
Well, right there in Nashville, Fisk University, the student movement there was very active. John Lewis, who's now, of course, in Congress, a civil rights icon, was an activist in those days with Jim Bevel and many others who basically took on the powers that be and took on segregation and were often chastised for their activism, really. I mean, their nonviolence, was made it harder for them to be, you know, attacked, but they were attacked anyway. And you, so were you. What happened? Remind us about the incident that you were involved in.
Well, I had gone to work. I had left journalism just briefly and went to work in the Kennedy administration, and the Freedom Rides came on, and the president was getting ready to go to meet with Khrushchev, and the violence came at Anniston on a Sunday afternoon.
Anniston, Alabama.
Yeah, Anniston, Alabama. And the next day at Birmingham, a mob gathered at the airport, and there were bomb threats every time there was a plane to take them to New Orleans, which was their destination. They had voted, and they physically were unable because of cracked skulls and broken bones. They were unable physically to continue the trip by bus, and Greyhound had had its bus burned and was not anxious to carry them, and so I was sent down really to get them out of Birmingham into New Orleans, and it's relatively easy if you're representing the president and the attorney general and the head of the Federal Aviation Authority to get Delta Airlines to cooperate, and they did cooperate, and they checked everybody's bags, and our Freedom Riders' bags, and my bag, and people who were on the plane other than the Freedom Riders, and so within a couple of hours, we were on our way and arrived in New Orleans, and I went home thinking I was thinking for a minute that I was the hero of the Kennedy administration, uh-huh. And next morning at 5 o'clock, the Attorney General woke me up. He had congratulated me the night before. Now he woke me up. And hearing that song that you described as one of the anthems of the movement reminds me that he said, who the hell is Diane Nash? And Diane Nash was a leader in the Nashville Sit-Ins movement. Close
right, friend I knew
of,
her.
Close to Jim, to John Lewis, married later, Jim Bevel. And he said, please call her. She started another trip of Freedom Riders down from Nashville. And you know, I called her and talked with her. That line, nobody going to turn us around, that's where she was. And no matter how impassioned I was, how graphically I described the brutality that was waiting them, nobody going to turn Diane around or John or Jim, and they were on their way. And so I had to go back up, and I tried to help them, and they got from Birmingham to Montgomery, and they were attacked. And in trying to help them, I was knocked unconscious first time in my life, and was hospitalized for several days. But I would have to say, looking back on it, it's the courage of those children that you really have to think about.
But there you were, a government official. It didn't matter. Representing the President of the United States, it didn't matter. The Attorney General, it didn't matter. You were one of them, you know, sort of an honorary nigger for the day in their view. And you were attacked, and it was, let's not downplay it, it was pretty serious to be knocked out.
Oh, I was unconscious on the sidewalk, kicked under the car for 30 minutes before the police ever showed up. All ambulances, they said, were on call, so there were two FBI agents, I'm sure they were undercover, but who saw me and left me there. And you think back on that time and you think, you know, what was this? How could our country have been? I mean, he was animalistic that day on that parking, on that Greyhound bus line parking lot. I mean, human beings, men and women and even some children, literally turned into vicious animals. And you could hear them screaming and hating, and it was not a day I'd ever want to relive.
Well, I have to tell you that this was one of the complaints, if you will, of the civil rights movement, of CORE and SNCC, of you know, John Edgar Hoover's FBI standing by while people were beaten and they were counting the blows, but not doing anything to protect them or to help them. And this was fed the perception that I think the Kennedy administration wanted to change, that the Justice Department, that the federal government was on the side of the segregationists.
Well, that was an image, and Hoover contributed immeasurably to that image. And I would have to tell you that when I got back after about 3 weeks, recuperated after the hospital, I came home to recuperate, got back to the office in about a little more than 3 weeks. I was well again and came in. The first thing I saw was a memorandum from J. Edgar Hoover to the President and Attorney General identifying the two men who had hit me by name, identifying them by name and where they lived and who they were and what their backgrounds were. And it was quite clear that local police were infiltrated by the Ku Klux Klan, and that Hoover and the FBI worked closely with local police on federal crimes like interstate transportation automobiles or kidnapping or treason, and because they were working on those problems with the local police, they too often turned a blind eye toward what was going on.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit. You've lived these last 50 years as a trenchant observer of what's happening in the South and as somebody who's been committed to First Amendment rights. Where are we now? I mean, I'm very worried about when I read reports of efforts supposedly in the name of voter integrity to make it harder for people to register to vote, largely in the South, where you have, efforts to try to impose English-only laws or to people have to have photo IDs or other, you know, evidence of their legitimacy. Seems to me all part of an effort to suppress the vote of poor people, black people, Latino people.
Oh, Danny, I mean, you're right on the money. I mean, we're still living too often too much in the past. And I'll just give you one quick anecdote. During those freedom rides, there were 14 Tennessee State University students expelled. Now, about 2 years ago, there was a movement underway to get them honorary degrees. The Board of Regents of Tennessee State Colleges voted 7-4 against giving honorary degrees to young people now in their 50s and 60s who risked their lives to change this country and make it a better place for everybody. And fortunately, the reaction to that vote was so overwhelming and so angry that within a couple of weeks, the Board of Regents reversed itself, voted unanimously to give them those honorary degrees. But, you know, here we are 48 years after the fact, and a Board of Regents can't understand.
Well,
it just reminds you that we're still living with it, just as you said.
It seems like there's a cabal of the ideologically righteous, you know, who believe that their view is the only view and no one else has a right to speak, and that they want to impose a parochial, you know, perception. Here in New York City, I don't know if you know about this one, John, but the City University of New York, one of the colleges, honored Tony Kushner, the great poet, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, who wrote Angels in America. Tony has also been very involved in the search for peace in the Middle East and edited a collection of articles calling for changes in, you know, Israeli policy, American policy, Palestinian policy, whatever, okay? One member of the board of trustees of this college here, part of the City University, convinced seven others not to strip him of his honorary degree. Why? Because he was trying to delegitimize the state of Israel by raising questions, you know, about practices and policies that everybody in the world has been discussing and raising practices. This is a similar situation. You know, somebody makes a comment that you don't like. You know, Helen Thomas, how many years in the White House as the dean of White House correspondence, and suddenly she's stripped of her, you know, she's booted out of the place, and basically there are people trying to take away the awards for lifetime achievement that she was given.
Oh, yeah, she's my great friend, and she's my close friend, and the injustice of that is papered over now by the fact that she has... that she has suffered immeasurably. Her reputation has been attacked. Her awards have been tainted. And I will tell you, her only crime is asking tough questions and speaking the truth. And she, what she said about the need for two states, Israel and Palestine, living together in peace. I mean, she said it as it was. It was straight from the shoulder and from the heart and from the head. And you know, people don't want to hear anything that runs against
yeah,
the grain of popular opinion.
I was with Helen in Washington the other week, and we had dinner together at a Palestinian restaurant. His food was quite good, actually. And, you know, she is still asking, why, what does my saying something about, you know, political situation mean that, why does that rob me of, you know, all these years of being in the White House? There's no answer I could give her. I know that in the Society for Professional Journalists, there's an effort going on right now to try to get them to roll back, a decision that they had reached very, very undemocratically, apparently, to strip her of her, honorary degree. Wayne State University in Detroit, where she was from, did the same.
Such an outrage because, you know, it's not just Helen who's been robbed. Think of the young people she was influencing, young journalists, young journalism students. I can't tell you, a half dozen times I've been either on a panel with her or in the audience when she was speaking to journalism students. They've been robbed of a role model like none other in my lifetime.
Did you consider her anti-Semitic, John?
No, not for a moment was she anti-Semitic. You know, she said what's on the mind of most Americans, you know. And she paid a price for it, and is still paying a price for it. And no, she's not anti-Semitic.
Well, I agree with you. And the reason I bring this up is because, you know, the battle in the South was not just it was a fight for freedom. It wasn't just a fight for the right to sit at a lunch counter or to get the vote. It was a freedom movement. And you know, you covered it. You know it better than me. You know, I was part of it, but in some ways from a distance. I was supporting the Freedom Riders in New York, Jim Peck, and some of the other people from CORE who were part of that movement back then. And, you know, I was very engaged in the civil rights movement, later went to Mississippi. And worked in Harlem. You know, so I'm aware of all of these things. But there is this point in our country where we could go backwards as easily as moving forwards. And this is the thing that is so worrisome, I think, to many of us. Because unless people are educated and respect and admire and believe in, you know, the First Amendment and the rights that we consider that differentiate our country from other countries, you know, people are willing in the heat of whatever the moment is to abandon these principles.
Well, you're dead right about that. And let me tell you, I'm now spend a great deal of time at the First Amendment Center in Vanderbilt. And I can tell you the number of complaints that come in about suppression of speech, a phenomenal number of people. Are being punished, and their rights are being taken away. They're being criticized. Some people are being fired. Some people are being treated as outcasts. There are some people in some newsrooms who express themselves and pay a penalty of isolation and alienation as a result of their candor, and it's a sad thing. And you know, everybody has an opinion, and you know, the sad thing about it is that when bad things happen to good people, too many other people remain silent. They're not willing to speak out. They're not willing to exercise their First Amendment rights, free speech. And the result is that the society suffers. Not just the victim of the attack suffers, but the society suffers. You know, when one of us loses rights or one of us is attacked because someone overstates something. I mean, the answer to bad speech is better speech. And that's what we're lacking today.
John, how old are you?
I will soon be 84 years old.
Okay. Well, that's a good run that you're having, and you're going to be with us for quite a while. But I just wanted the audience here to appreciate, you know, the wisdom and experience of a great newspaper man and upstanding fighter, you know, for civil liberties and for the First Amendment. How can people find out more about the First Amendment Center? I actually have an album of music and songs that you guys released.
Yes, that we're located on the Vanderbilt campus, and it's you can find us online without any difficulty. We're part of the Freedom Forum and the museum in Washington, but the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt is directly connected to the Freedom Forum and to the museum. We're funded by the Freedom Forum.
You know, I was just down at the museum for a conference, the first national conference by Al Jazeera Television at the museum just a few weeks ago, and I was invited to come. And it was a fantastically interesting conversation. Arab journalists challenging and, you know, interviewing, Bob Woodward, you know, this big new Brzezinski talking about Middle East policy being questioned sharply, debates underway about. It was just a whole environment of journalism and caring about the world that we don't see very much, you know, in many of our media conferences where we're talking about Twitter and Facebook and, you know, technology issues, not about principles and the news, you know. And I think what I was very heartened by what they were doing there, and I was glad that the museum, basically in a night center there, you know, hosted them or allowed them to use the place for this conference. It was quite
interesting. Well, I am too. I'm on the board of the museum and the board of the Freedom Forum, and we're very proud of that $450 million building there next to the Canadian Embassy. And I'll tell you, that is one place that's open to all points of view. And it doesn't, you know, it may have surprised some people that Al Jazeera was welcome there for that conference, but it should not, because it's welcome to all voices.
Absolutely, and I just want to please pass on my, you know, respect and appreciation for that event, because I thought it was really excellent event and very important, and more Americans clearly should understand that Al Jazeera still can't even get on the air in most parts of the United States, where they're on the air all over the world as one of the top news networks, and yet where they're still sort of demonized and sniggled about and sniffed about and, you know, castigated by some who people don't really know anything, know nothing, so to speak, in America. So, John Siegenthaler, thank you so much for coming on the program today, sharing a little bit of your experience. We really appreciated it. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. You can reach me at danny@mediachannel.org. NewsDissector.com is my blog. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com is the website for my film on the financial crisis as a crime story. Hope to be back with you next week here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
40% of the stations carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, murdering is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, baby?
of them.